This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There are other reasons to like brick streets than historical authenticity or neighborhood environment. Former Historic Preservation Commission member Brad Williams says economics are a factor, too, in Bloomington.
Asphalt goes up 6% every year. It's not going to be long-term. It's not going to be a viable alternative to have asphalt. So I think you got to look at something else.
A master plan for brick streets in Bloomington revived and considered. Plus, the McLean County GOP Facebook page has a post that has gone viral and is controversial. We'll explore that. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. McLean County Republican Party Chair Chuck Erickson is in the hot seat over a Facebook post that sided with President Trump and his widely denounced both sides remarks on Charlottesville. Erickson spent this morning trying to clarify what he said on Facebook, even as other local Republicans criticized his comments. GLT's Ryan Denham spoke to Erickson and several other Republicans this morning. He is here in studio to help unpack this for us.
Last night, the McLean County Republican Party's Facebook page at around 7 o'clock posted about a one-paragraph statement about what happened in Charlottesville. And the part that people are concerned about is that it blamed some of the counter-protesters in part for the violence that we saw in Charlottesville, instead of putting the focus squarely on, you know, the white supremacists who were really at the core of that event. It cited Trump's comments on this. And there's a pretty quick backlash. By this morning, so 12 hours later, there was already 100 comments on the post. It was spreading very quickly. It was going viral in every sense of the word. And that surprised Chuck Erickson, who is the chair of the McLean County Republican Party. He tried to issue a clarifying statement this morning. It was a lengthier statement denouncing the KKK and Nazis and white supremacists. But it still held on to that notion that the left, the counter-protesters on the left, were still partly responsible.
I think it went viral, and I think there were a lot of misrepresentations in the comments about what was said and what are the views of the McLean County Republican Party. And so I felt that that needed to be corrected.
Who did write the post?
That was Chuck Erickson. So he is, in addition to being the McLean County Republican Party chair, he's also on the county board. And he's the spokesman for the party. He doesn't need to run these messages through the party's executive committee. It's not like they floated this around to a bunch of people last night and they all signed off on it and it was posted. It sounds like it was a one-man show. He has direct access to that Facebook page. And, you know, he personally comments on the post himself, as opposed to the party. So it appears to be Chuck.
How are other Republicans reacting?
The range of reaction is, you know, from disappointment to shock. That reaction started coming in very quickly, first on Facebook. You saw local elected officials like Jason Chambers, the state's attorney, chiming in saying that it was wrong. I spoke to a handful of folks this morning, local Republicans, some elected office, some not, about what they thought of all this. And I think state's attorney Jason Chambers summed it up pretty well.
I'll be honest, I'm at a lost for words on a lot of things on this. I normally am not. I think most people who know me know that I'm not normally at a loss for words. But if there's a debate or hedging over whether or not the Nazis or the KKK are bad, I'm not gonna stand there along with saying that.
Even members of the McLean County Republican Party's executive committee, so part of their top leadership, are disappointed in this. A normal town council member, Scott Preston, was one of them.
You know, I perceived the initial Facebook post last night the same way that many people did, was quite disappointed, to say the least, by how I perceived it. I do know Chuck, and I believe he certainly did not intend for it to come out how a lot of people, I think, perceived it.
who all is on the executive committee?
So it's a range of people. Scott Presson, as you heard from the Normal Town Council, is one of them, even though those positions are nonpartisan. George Wendt from the McLean County Board would be another. Interestingly, yesterday I was looking at the list of executive committee members on the party's website. This is last night. And there was the list of those members. This morning, when I went to check that page was no longer on the site. That list was not publicly accessible.
Why is that?
That's a good question. I asked Chuck, and he said he doesn't have access to make changes to the site like that. And, you know, the two people who do, he wouldn't give me their names, but said that others do have access to it. He didn't know why that change was made. Still trying to get to the bottom of that, but I found it interesting because I think someone would think that a lot of executive committee members would be called by the media today to get their feedback on what had been posted. So that page disappearing overnight was interesting to me.
Or the public might be calling them.
Correct.
How will this impact the Republican Party brand?
So that is the big question, I think. There are some hotly contested elections next year. So the Democratic Party locally is sort of emboldened after that, after suffering the Donald Trump loss. And, you know, they picked up those key seats on the Normal Township board. They're going to be running a candidate for McLean County Clerk against Kathy Michael. That's Nikita Richards. And so this issue popping up now could potentially be damaging for that brand. And how will it impact moderate Republicans and how they see the party locally? So I asked that to a lot of the Republicans I spoke to this morning. Josh Barnett is on the McLean County Board. He's a Republican, fairly moderate, lives in southeast Bloomington. And here's what he had to say about that brand question.
I think that's certainly a concern that this could hurt the Republican brand locally by bringing a national issue that is, it's a terrible thing, what happened in Virginia and the president's response to it. But to bring that here locally and to endorse the president's comments, I think that certainly could hurt the brand.
I also asked Chuck Erickson about this issue as well.
I don't think the Post would have done anything to hurt the brand, but the fact that some have construed it to potentially be hurtful to the brand, then I need to, as chairman, exercise my responsibility to clarify the thoughts in which that original statement was made. And that's what I've done. And I think I've done what I can do to condemn the bad actors on all sides and would encourage people that, like I said initially, if someone engages in an act of violence against you, your response, unless it's in self-defense, has to be measured by the rule of law.
Bad actors on all sides, but part of the weight of criticism of President Trump on this issue is that there don't appear to have been bad actors in Charlottesville on the other side, and that it sets up a false equivalency. And is Chuck buying into that?
It appears so. It's difficult to say, and it's difficult to really say what the party gains politically by sharing this viewpoint on its page in this manner. It's hard to say.
Is anybody calling for him to resign?
No, not publicly yet. You know, I gave him credit. He did speak to me this morning. He's been speaking to a lot of local media on this matter, trying to clarify what was posted. So give him credit for that. Josh Barnett, again from the McLean County Board, a moderate Republican, he told me that Chuck may need to do some soul-searching about whether his voice should be the one that represents the local party moving forward.
That post, does it really represent the party, or does it represent Chuck Erickson? And I think that's where there is some fuzzy area there.
So we'll have to wait and see if pressure builds on Chuck over the next month or two on this issue.
That's GLT's digital content director Ryan Denham reporting today on the McLean County Republican Party's controversial Facebook post last night. More on the story, including Erickson's full clarifying statement from this morning, on our website, WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The city of Bloomington may be a step closer to adopting a brick streets master plan shelved back in 2009. Months of conversation between the city's Public Works Department and members of the Historic Preservation Commission have resulted in a draft plan that all sides think will be approved by the commission tomorrow evening and eventually by the city council. GLT's Mike McCurdy talked with Historic Preservation Commission Vice Chairman Leah Klein, former longtime commission member Brad Williams, and Public Works Director Jim Karch, who says a plan to asphalt over a 100-year brick section of East Monroe brought the issue back to the surface.
Well, the city of Bloomington actually received a petition from the residents along Monroe, just west between Robinson and to the west. And so most of the residents along that block asked for that street to, that brick street. It's currently brick. They asked for it to be resurfaced. They asked for it to have asphalt on it. We sent out letters to folks to try to make sure that's what they want to do. And really by sending letters, talking to the residents along there, they wanted something done with the street, but ideally they would really like to have it be brick, is kind of the resounding voice that we're hearing. So that reinvigorated the discussions from back in 2009 when staff first started to look at a brick streets master plan.
And are the lines of communication now open between HPC and Public Works? It seemed like at the council meeting where this sort of came to light, there seemed to be some miscommunication or a lack of communication.
Well, what's been great is that we've actually been meeting directly with Historic Preservation Commission members, really getting their feedback both at meetings and then in smaller groups to make sure that we're getting some good feedback and interaction. And so that's allowed us to actually make some very good, significant changes to the plan. Back in 2009, we did actually reach out. We had multiple meetings with the HPC. And so that was part of it. But then once that really died off and did not continue, then we really didn't have any direction as a staff. And so we continued doing what had always been done.
And Leah?
I think the Monroe Street case really brought to light for all of us how broken those lines of communication had become. And I think the benefit from this, and I, of course, wish the residents of Monroe Street didn't have to get to this point, but the benefit is that at this point there is really a clear and open line of communication between city staff and the Historic Preservation Commission. In the end, we all have the same goal in mind, which is to make the streets, whether they be brick or not, as up to date and passable as they can be. But the HPC has its own goals, which are to make sure that the historic characteristics of the city remain. So it's good now to be involved and to be that kind of reminder to the city staff about what our charge is and what we are interested in protecting. The bottom line is, once we got to the city council meeting and those residents showed up, and in speaking with Amelia Burgess, it ended up that the residents said, well, if we have come to the conclusion that the city isn't going to fix the brick street. So our only outlet now is to ask for it to be resurfaced.
So they didn't realize it was an option.
Well,
or could
because
be
there
an
wasn't
option.
Any infrastructure, there wasn't any plan in place mm-hmm. that would allow them to go that route. So essentially the council said, let's sort of hit the brakes and say, how can we now put a plan into place so that these residents, if they want to keep the brick street, they're going to be able to do that, right? And they can choose not to, but we want to give them at least an outlet to be able to choose to keep the brick street.
And Brad Williams, former chair of the Historic Preservation Commission, a brick street proponent. Why should any of us care about brick streets?
I think bottom line for, and looking from the perspective of Jim Karch and the city of Bloomington, I think it's a responsible thing to do economically. Asphalt goes up 6% every year. It's not going to be long term. It's not going to be a viable alternative to have asphalt. So I think you got to look at something else. It's not as monotonous looking as asphalt. Sounds really nice.
When the cars go over it.
There's pluses and minuses to every surface. Long term, though, it's going to hold up better.
Leah, same question. Why should we care about brick streets?
I think the brick streets are such a beautiful sort of recollection of the past. I mean, I know most people, I didn't grow up in a city that had brick streets. I grew up in Louisiana where floods and hurricanes have ruined all of them. So when I moved here, the idea of, you know, driving over the brick streets was just sort of a little reminder of the city is, you know, was here since 1833. This is a very old city. It's got great traditions. It's also a good traffic calmer. People slow down on brick streets. They do have a real kind of nice visual appeal, but as someone who's interested in the historic traditions of our city, it's, for me, it's a nice little reminder of who we are.
And Jim, you're a fan of brick streets. You told me this.
Yeah, I actually grew up on a brick street. And so just that aesthetic appeal, and not just that, but as both Leah and then also, you know, we look at that. Just Leah, like you just said, it's really the historic feel for this area. You know, we really give a lot of, we have to give a lot of credence to this community that Bloomington has a rich history with our brick streets. And I think that we have to acknowledge that. And so what we're trying to do, what we see this as a benefit is staff needs to have that additional direction. From a policy perspective, how do we approach that? How do we prioritize the brick streets? How do we make sure that the funding is there, that we have the right direction so that we can make sure we preserve what we have and we look at kind of where we move forward with brick streets?
So, Jim, the city had no way to really rectify the problems on East Monroe.
Well, and I give Brad Williams a lot of credit. Whenever he was part of the Historic Preservation Commission before, he was a good voice whenever staff brought up this issue back in 2009. And so Brad and the other folks on the HPC back then, we held multiple meetings to try to make sure there was some clear direction. Between then and now, they're really, for staff, it dropped off. With all of the different needs, when the bottom dropped out of this community from a financial standpoint, it really became difficult to focus on even aesthetical things like the you know, brick streets and the importance of them.
Well, so the city sort of had ended up with a default policy, though, in essence, which was was to asphalt over them, right?
And we had done that. We have actually lost some brick streets since 2009, or portions of them, because there was not a policy or master plan in place.
So what happened? What was the origin of the 2009? Brick Street master plan?
Well, whenever I started as public works director, that was actually the first master plan that I started. And quite honestly, that was whenever I started, I cared about having objective ratings of all of our infrastructure. I wanted to have a logical way to approach what we did. And our brick streets seemed to be a tenable way to start. They seemed to be a good way to be able to, I thought at the time, a simple way for us to begin, come up with some ratings. And so it was a very basic plan back then that we really got some great cooperation from Rock Island on their plan. And so it seemed like an easy place to start.
And what happened to it?
Well, again, whenever priorities changed with the dropping out of the financial bucket in this community, it was very difficult without resources. And so it didn't get back to the, you know, really didn't get back to the council for action.
Couldn't the plan have been forwarded to the city council, but then not really implemented? I mean, at least you would have had the guidelines on the books.
Yeah, difficult to say, but I really think a lot of it came down to the priorities of what as a staff that was going on. I think at that time, administration was doing the best they could to be able to manage the issues that they had, and so this got on the back burner. And so I really think an issue like Monroe, it was what was needed, because I think there's a lot of support from our council right now to look at this issue and make sure that it's assessed.
Yeah, and there's a lot of support from the community. When we had that council meeting, when this issue of Monroe Street came up, there were at least 50 or so members of the community who showed up. And I think that was really impressive to the council members. It was to me, and I think to city staff too, to see just how many people, when you ask them, do you care about this, they will show up and say, yes, I do. They just needed someone to give them the avenue, someone to give them an infrastructure, you know, with which to approach the city to have things fixed and the like.
So what have we lost over the last 8 years since there wasn't a master plan and you know, repairs had to be made?
Yes, I can actually identify a few that they were, again, resident, and they're actually in the newest plan that I would encourage residents to go out and look at. First, I'd like to say our City of Bloomington website, www.cityblm.org. And if you look on the Public Works Master Plan page, there is an updated link, and so we really would encourage citizens to go out and look at it, look at the prioritization, look at how we're trying to structure the overall plan. But since the 2009 and this current draft, there's areas like Elm over by Trinity Lutheran, just west of Center. There's over by Chestnut and Mason over in that area, and all of those were, again, just like Monroe would have been, driven by residents who at the time had no other avenue, and so the street was in such a condition that they wanted something done.
So what about the new draft? How much of the old plan is in the new plan, and is this a solid start, or does it need more work? Leah, I'll start with you.
I think it's a solid start. Every plan is an imperfect plan, right? Mm-hmm. That our priorities will change over time. But I think what's good about it is it sets forward a certain series of assumptions. that the brick streets are important, that the residents want them preserved, and the city should have them preserved where possible, right? So this is a general sense that we are standing in recognition of what our priorities are. But it also lays out a nice framework for how to approach them. You know, we don't have that many of these left, but they all seem to need help. There are very few of them that seem to be in perfect condition. So how do we take what we have? How can we assess what we have? What are the priorities that we make? So the plan sets all of these sorts of ideas out in a real clear sense. So at least as a member of the HPC and as a resident of Bloomington, I know that if there's a cut, for instance, that happens in Allen Street near on the west side where I live, I know that the next morning the city is not going to fill it up with concrete, right? That there's a plan now that's going to at least think about what to do in a more, I'd say, more forgiving way for the brick streets, right? Rather than just sort of, you know, patching and moving on, that we're actually approaching things with an underlying assumption that the brick streets are important, and how we go about fixing them is a weighted model, as it were, based on the, you know, the need of the street, not really so much, you know, a west side, east side thing, but the weight of the street and the sort of historic nature of the area in which that street is located, so that we can help to find some sort of path forward to tackling a whole lot of problems, right? I don't envy city staff and having to deal with so many problems, because I don't think there aren't many people who live on a brick street who would say, oh, ours is fine, right? Everyone has a problem. So we need to be able to have a rational way forward.
And as a long-term member of the HPC, a former member of the HPC, this must sound good to you, Brad.
Yes.
You're happy with the way things are going?
Yeah, I am, and I see on the brand new plan that just came out today, there's some weight when it becomes necessary. The historic districts are weighted slightly as far as getting repairs done. When there's equal repair jobs on other streets, historic districts get a little more priority. I feel like that has needed to happen because the historic district's been around a long time, and I'd like to see those recognized a little bit.
And that was a point of contention among some HPC members.
Right, and I think what has changed with this new version of the plan, which I appreciate, is that there's some acknowledgement of potential historic districts, right? Because there are areas of our city that we would like to see preserved and not allowed to degrade, right? Areas like South Hill, the Miller Park area, that there are some really wonderful historic characteristics there, although it hasn't yet been fully designated as a historic district. So now, yes, the historic districts go first, but areas where historic designation is possible down the road, that we're not actually taking away that possibility for the residents, right? That we're maintaining that possibility in the future for them.
That allows a more holistic triage sort of approach. How much back and forth between Public Works and HPC in the last week to sort of arrive at the new draft?
Actually, quite a bit. We've had a good partnership. There's been a good partnership moving through to this point to really find a compromise on what we'd call the prioritization model that we're using. We proposed a few different models whenever we started off, and so that's where there was some difficulty. How do you find a way to really give weight and real measure? Because everybody looks at the streets differently. No, there's really not a wrong way. It is just, how do you weight that? And so we really tried to find a compromise to look at two different types of brick streets. We look at the streets that need patching. And so those that are in great shape, but just have a couple of concrete patches. And then, let's be honest, the ones that are in really in need of, they need a lot of tender loving care. they're in really bad shape. And whenever you drive them, you have to, it's very bumpy. It's very tenuous. And so those are the ones that we look at more reconstruct. And so we tried to break it out into those two different types of categories, looking at the ones that need to be patched. Those we looked at the best ones first. And the ones that need to be reconstructed, we looked at the worst streets first. Which ones are in the worst condition?
So tell me a little more about the prioritization assumptions that make brick streets good candidates for preservation, and how do those assumptions intersect with the prioritization categories?
Well, we assume that all brick streets need preservation. So this plan starts with the assumption that the 3.5 miles of brick streets that are remaining in this community need to be preserved. Originally, we had over 40 miles of brick streets in this community, and over time, we've lost a lot of those. And so now it is really, let's make sure we preserve them. So how we do that is we say we will look at the ones in the plan that, again, like the Monroe, like Taylor, that have, they're in worse condition. And so we first look at their, we rate them through using just an objective rating system to say which one is the worst. And then once you categorize those using this, University of Wisconsin-Madison has a nationally recognized system for rating brick streets. And we have involved that and moved that into a standard 1 to 10 point system. And that's something our council and citizens are used to with how we rate our streets, our alleys, our sidewalks. And so first we put them into those categories of a rating. After that, when there are multiple streets within one category of a rating, then we look at the historic district, whether it's in a potential historic district. And then if those still have the same measure in the same area, we then look at what type of overall area needs to be worked on. And so is it a larger area? Well, then that should take a higher priority under the reconstruction model.
So in one of the drafts, I saw a part about, saw something I thought was interesting, was about adjacent homeowners needing to sign off on this 80% or so. Why is that necessary? Don't these streets belong to everyone, not just the people that live on the street?
And it's interesting. We actually started off in 2009 and we were looking at some criteria like that. And that's actually no longer in the plan. And so that's one we pulled out for those kind of reasons. We really were trying to find ways, especially in the beginning, just like Leah had said, this isn't a perfect plan. It isn't the end all be all there. Even in the end, there are future considerations and areas we look at. But we're trying to find something we can be unified on. We can try to come forward and say, let's have something to start with so we can start with day one. We can start preserving what we have.
And you must be happy that that's out of the, the previous draft.
I totally agree with city staff's desire to have community buy-in, to have participation from the citizens. But I think that there comes a point where we have to be aware that that kind of setup can be privileging of a certain resident in the community, right? The people who have the time, the money, the knowledge to and how to approach those kinds of involvements with the city, right, who aren't afraid to do that. And I think I agree that the brick streets belong to everybody, no matter where they are. And so that is, for me at least, a guiding assumption. I understand, again, having the community's involvement, but I don't think it has to be those neighbors necessarily that are involved. That the city, I recognize that brick streets across the city are worth saving, and I'm willing to volunteer to help make those survive, even if they're not in my neighborhood. And I think we'll find that to be the case outside of just the HPC.
So has Public Works and HPC at this point reached a draft version of this master plan that the majority of the HPC will likely support on the 17th?
I believe so. It's still very important that residents of Bloomington who are interested in this topic come to the meeting on the 17th. We have gotten a lot of good suggestions from members of the community who've shown up and voiced their opinions, because people care about this and they want to be heard, and we're glad to hear them. I think at this point the plan is in good shape. I think we have a little bit of work to do about how much the funding level should be, and how that should be played out over the 10-year period that's being proposed in the plan. But those are more positive discussions. We're not at loggerheads about this, but we're really thinking how optimistic can we be about funding? How much money can we ask for, and how much can we do in the short term? Because I said at our last meeting, I really feel like from my exposure to the community that there are some people who are really upset. They're really unhappy that the brick streets in their neighborhood have been allowed to deteriorate in such a way that it would make a community member say, I would rather have asphalt at this point. They're angry about that. So how can we triage, in a sense, those neighborhoods to make those residents feel that they have been heard and that we are acting upon their concerns while still having a long-term plan that has to be measured and very rational, right? Pulling up and redoing an entire brick street is an incredibly big undertaking. It requires a lot of money and time and energy. We can't do all of them at once, but we can do some things in the short term that will make our commitment to brick street reconstruction and sort of salvation visible to the city residents.
Leah Klein is the vice chair of the Historic Preservation Commission. GLT's Mike McCurdy also spoke with former Historic Preservation Commission member Brad Williams and Bloomington Public Works Director Jim Karch. The draft plan also includes a spending recommendation, $500,000 over 10 years. And while the initial cost of a brick street is more, it can outlast asphalt by more than 70 years. The commission meets tomorrow in Bloomington City Hall at 5:30.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, a partnership of Advocate Bromen and OSF Healthcare, offering the latest technology and diagnostic services and cancer treatments, along with time-honored traditions in supportive care. Located at 407 East Vernon in Normal. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The recent budget crisis in Illinois created real problems for college students across the state, some of whom opted to find less monetary uncertainty in colleges in other states. While Eastern Illinois University's freshman enrollment is down 13%, Illinois State University has weathered the fiscal crisis in better shape enrollment-wise. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
At this moment, harried parents are offloading their 18-year-old student's life into a dorm room at Illinois State University. Posters will go up on the walls, wireless and real-time connections will be made, and another school year will begin. This year's incoming freshman class at Illinois State University is a little over 3,300. Those are strong numbers, says Jeff Mavros, director of admissions at ISU. Jana Albrecht, interim vice president for enrollment management and formerly financial aid director, says that is despite recent difficulties with the lack of a state budget.
But that's still going to be pretty big if we look at the last 10 years of incoming freshman classes. We won't break our record of last year, but we're still pretty excited about the number of students that we're going to have on campus.
Yeah, these last four classes collectively have been the largest four classes in decades for the institution.
To what do you attribute that?
It's a number of things. We've got a great product to sell here at Illinois State, and I think with the ongoing development that happens in Uptown, with great leadership at the institution, an incredible marketing effort by so many around campus, Jana and I would probably be the first to tell you that recruitment and retention of students and what we call enrollment at large, it's a team sport. We probably get more credit or blame than we deserve, quite honestly, for the numbers. And we're really fortunate to work at a place that gets it. And it's a community that pulls together to attract students. And every one of us that interacts with a student makes an impression. So there are a lot of things going in our direction right now.
Let's talk about the demographics of the incoming class. Are we seeing a wide amount of diversity? For example, I know that President Dietz has said he's wanted to be bringing in more foreign students to Illinois State. What are we seeing demographically?
Sure. Demographically, over the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years, we have grown significantly for our underrepresented population. So last year, I think, because we don't look at numbers until 10th day, so we can't tell you for sure how that split will come out. But last year, we were, I think, almost 29% of our students were non-white. And so that would include international students as well. But right now, our international population is a bit small. It's probably only about 1% of our population. But overall, we are about 29% diverse for our incoming class from last year.
So what trends are you seeing regarding enrollment at Illinois State University?
Well, as we discussed, enrollment is up for incoming freshmen. We also have a really large transfer contingent. We're the number one destination in Illinois for transfer students. We're very proud of that.
So how many ISU grads started elsewhere?
About 34%, actually, of our current student body started at another institution. So again, that's a real point of pride for us.
What's the appeal of transferring students to Illinois State University? How do you snatch them and grab them over here?
We have a really good place to attend. And we often tell students we like them to look at the college scorecard where they can look at our retention rates and our graduation rates. And if you compare us to even in the Midwest, we just fare very favorably on a lot of those points. And I do, you know, we say a lot of times that it's a big school with that small school feel. And I really feel that a lot of students are attracted to that, and they appreciate that, and they want that. The fact that they have so many opportunities for majors, for things to do on campus as far as, you know, group activity, and that you can walk across campus in 10 or 15 minutes. And Jeff actually has a video that shows a student walking across our entire campus in that amount of time. So we have a really good product. A really good school, and people feel extremely comfortable and that they're going to succeed when they come.
For a school of almost 21,000 in total, our average class size is still 33. And so I think for those students that are in a community college, as you mentioned, that are used to that kind of learning environment, while it's a transition to move on to an institution like ours, at least from the academic environment kind of setting, it's pretty comfortable for them.
Well, of course, we just came off of about 2 years of not having a budget in the state of Illinois. That, of course, had to impact admissions here at Illinois State University. What sort of pressures have you been facing from out-of-state schools and how they are circling maybe to take students who feel insecure being here, worried about the future? with what's going on in Springfield?
Yeah, this is a big issue for us in terms of just our marketing position and the landscape here in Illinois and in the Midwest. The budget woes of the past few years have really taken a toll on Illinois schools in general. We, as we've talked about, have been very fortunate to keep our enrollment where it's needed to be and actually enroll larger classes than we have historically over the last couple of years, but we've been bucking the trend. So believe it or not, last year, 45% of Illinois high school graduates went out of state for college. And we haven't yet seen the numbers for this year's graduating high school seniors. But if anything, it's going in that same direction where we're seeing greater and greater numbers of students leave the state. And it's, as you said, it's a little bit of shaken confidence in the state of Illinois. So we certainly hope, Jana and I hope, that with the budget put in place for this year, we're going to see that kind of level off a bit. You know, our outcomes speak for themselves. So we're really hoping that Illinois families will continue to consider Illinois schools. And we've got a number of them. Illinois State's an incredible example of that. But there are a number of good opportunities for students, good options for students right here in Illinois.
Are you hearing from parents as well who are expressing their concern regarding their children?
We are. There are a few students that have shared with us just here at the end of our process, and for the most part, May 1st is that national deadline date by which students should make a decision about the coming fall. I say for the most part because anymore, a lot of schools will stay open throughout the summer as they haven't quite made enrollments and they're looking to continue to attract students. But by May 1, the majority of students have made their decisions about where they're going to attend for the coming fall. We've had a few students and families tell us that we did everything right in the process. They loved everybody they met at Illinois State. Everything was what they were hoping, and yet they decided to go elsewhere as a result of the budget and just their level of uncertainty in what might happen for the future.
What about MAP grant students? Are they increasingly wary of going to Illinois State University or any Illinois school because of the past 2 years of what we've been through? How can you help the MAP grant students feel more comfortable?
So we have on campus just over 4,000 students that actually receive some sort of MAP grant. And it's a large award. It's, you know, $4,720 is the maximum award at ISU. And so to try and help those students be comfortable with the fact that we have to write on their award letter that it's an estimated award and that we can't tell them for sure if those funds are going to come through for the state. The good news for us is that the university has been able to help reassure the students, and if that MAP grant isn't going to come through, that the university would figure out a way to cover them. Now, had that gone on for years and years and years, you just, you know, you don't know what you could do with that. But we hear daily in the financial aid office families calling concerned about their MAP grant and whether they're going to receive those funds. So you can imagine that, you know, for families that make $0 to $50,000 a year who are primarily receiving those funds, in order for them to try and figure out how to fill a gap of $5,000 is very stressful. And in times, you know, there might not be any other form of aid that they can fill that gap with. You know, they're reluctant to take on any more student loans. So even if you give them those student loan options, it might not be something that those families want to do. And with us having the number of MAP grant recipients on campus, we're constantly trying to monitor that and to tell them that we're going to do everything we can to help them continue their education. But it is something that we've heard more and more of over the last 3 years.
During the 2 years when we didn't have a budget and things were very, you know, people couldn't get the money for their grants and it was very nerve-wracking not having a budget, how do you guys keep your spirits up in admissions and in financial aid? I mean, that's a lot to deal with. You're having to deal with a lot of freaked out students and a lot of freaked out parents.
For me, a lot of that, and for people that I work with, I think a lot of it stems from the fact that we are in such a good environment on the campus. We support each other. It's a fun place to come and work. And so there aren't always great days where, you know, you feel like that everything's worth it and you've done a great job. I think most of the days you feel very supported, and we feel very good about Illinois State University and how students do come and they do graduate and they do stay and they are able to go into the workforce and get jobs. And our student loan default rate, which we haven't sort of mentioned yet, is way below that of the national average. So we have a very successful university and very successful students that graduate. And that, you know, that can make all the difference in the world when you know you're helping those students.
The default rate, why is that so good?
So I really think the default rate stems from having good programs, good faculty. They get a very good education. Our career center is fabulous, so they help students find the jobs that they want and get them placed in positions that they want.
So they can pay for their education.
Right. So I think we do a really good job of training and teaching and preparing the students for the workforce.
As folks in admissions, how do you reach out to students in this hyper-competitive environment? Are you using technology a lot more? What are you using as a way to reach them in a way to really get them?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's almost, what are we not using? You've got to find ways to reach students in all sorts of media and where they are. And certainly you mentioned technology, social media. We know students are walking around with their phones at all hours of the day, at all times. So yes, we are using social media on several platforms to engage students at the prospect level, at the inquiry level, at the applicant level, all the way through the different stages of involvement with the institution. But we texted just this year was our first kind of piloting of texting students, mm-hmm. and we texted admitted students who had applied.
How did that go?
You know, we're just now kind of closing that first run, seeing as the class is about to enter. And so now we're going to be able to look back and say, okay, what kind of impact did texting have? Anecdotally, I think it was a great response. We limited our texting to those who had applied and been admitted, and we were texting them mostly about the next steps in the process, be that filing financial aid paperwork, be it upcoming events that were in their area, things that we would like them to do to take the next steps to becoming a Redbird.
Well, we have mentioned community colleges and transfer students and that sort of thing. Jeff, can you expand on this partnership with Heartland Community College to get more transfer students over here? I mean, how's the relationship developing with Heartland?
Heartland's a great partner of ours. We're really fortunate to have such a great community college right here in our community. And so it's a great resource for students here locally. And it's been a great pathway for incoming Illinois State students. So they are by far our number one feeder of community college students to Illinois State. We've got great relationships with the advisors over in there at Heartland. And they've been very open to us having actual office hours on their campus physically. I've got a member of my staff that is at Heartland at least 2, sometimes 3 days a week. And we'll do some admission on the spot where we can review some materials and provide an admissions decision right there in front of a student. I think your question referenced the recent guaranteed admission program that we've inked with Heartland, which is great. And it's a chance to really just show a pathway for students so that if they're a year or two out from wanting to be at Illinois State, we're now able to tell them with certainty, you meet these certain criteria and we'll automatically guarantee you admission to the university of your choice. And so it's a great thing for community college students that may have a plan, but it's not solidified. And this helps them make that decision to say, oh, I know now I've got this chart of a path to Illinois State.
That's Jeff Mavros, Director of Admissions, and Jana Albrecht, Interim Vice President for Enrollment Management and formerly Financial Aid Director at Illinois State University. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Classes at Illinois State University begin Monday the 21st. Early enrollment projections suggest ISU will have between 200 and 700 fewer students than last year. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. St. Louis-based singer-songwriter Beth Bambara makes a stop in Chillicothe Sunday to play the Public Library at 2 p.m. She'll be featuring songs from her new album, Maps and No Direction. GLT's John Norton caught up with Bambara via Skype to talk about music and some of the inspiration behind her new album.
The name of the song is Map and No Direction. It's a title track from the brand new album by Beth Bambara, who joins us via Skype from her home in St. Louis. First of all, Beth, welcome to GLT and congratulations on the album.
Thank you so much, John.
You have said that the title track comes out of a time where you were in a pretty deep funk, or maybe depression is the word to describe it. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate.
What kind of funk were you in? Why were you in a depression?
Well, I think it's one of those things that kind of slowly sneaks up on you and you don't really kind of realize, I guess, what's going on. A lot of things compounded, a lot of little things together. And then you just wake up one day and, it's just like, oh my gosh, what is wrong with me? I can't get out of bed. I can't do anything. And so, I think it's not one thing, like I said, a lot of compounded things. And what I really found is I kind of had to face that. And a great way for me to do that was just to start writing. And so I used writing to kind of, one, I hadn't been able to write anything in a long time. And two, just taking that idea of like, okay, I got to figure out what's going on. And so I wrote my way through it, I guess. Songwriting kind of became my meditation, my therapy. And that's kind of how the song Map in No Direction got written.
Was the funk related at all to your music career?
Yeah, I think you could say that was part of it. It's just being on the road a lot is hard. It can be very demanding, and it gets tiring, and yeah.
Yeah, if there's one thing a musician has is a map, and with no direction, that can be a little disorienting, I would think, right? Do you feel at all that, away from the personal stuff, but to the music itself, do you feel that, you know, you have some direction now, that you're finding a groove with your music and your career, or do you feel like you found that before?
Yeah, I feel like now I have more of a better idea of what I'm trying to do. A lot of it just comes back to, you know, I always want to make sure that I'm still having fun. And I know a lot of musicians experience a burnout and just quit, or, you know, kind of disappear for a long time. But just getting back to rediscovering kind of why I love music in the first place.
Why did you love music in the first place?
It's just there's something about getting together with a group of people and playing, whether that's like improvising or really kind of honing in on a song and working out parts. The collaborative effort of it is something I really love about it. And just taking ideas and creating something from nothing is a really inspiring and fun experience. So you have that, the creative side of it is something I really love. And then also the performing side of it. When you're playing to a really intimate crowd and you're singing a serious song or a happy song, and you can kind of see your audience's emotions connect with your emotions that you're trying to get across in the song, like that's a really powerful thing that I love about music. It's kind of this universal language, and you can share these moments with the audience. Are we living life? It's tugging at my insides. You know I had my doubts when you said you'd stay by my side.
You're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Our guest is Beth Bambara, who's going to be at the Chillicothe Library on Sunday. You mentioned that getting back to performing, getting back to working with other people helped you through it. Is that something that you worked with other musicians down in St. Louis, or did you work with just your own people for this new album on that?
So we went to Portland, Oregon, and that's where we recorded a lot of the new album. So working with one of our friends, Carl Kling, a producer and a musician in his own right. So kind of getting out of my comfort zone with that and working with new people really helped. And another thing I had done was I picked up a gig playing bass guitar with another band that was doing a tour. So that was another thing that kind of like gave me a creative outlet, but it wasn't... It didn't feel as daunting because it wasn't my own music.
Sometimes being not the boss can be reinvigorating.
Exactly, yeah. And I really experienced that.
You're originally from Michigan, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Now you've been in St. Louis for a while. The city itself has a rich musical history. How, if at all, has the music of St. Louis and the history of the music of St. Louis affected your music at all?
Yeah, well, it's this funny thing. I didn't think about it until I moved here, but I really experienced, even in my travels, but especially moving to St. Louis, there really is this thing, even with the internet, and you can go and listen to any type of music you want now, there really is this thing you experience being in a physical place. There really is this culture attached to it. And so I had never really experienced a lot of folk or blues music. And so when I moved to St. Louis, that is really prevalent here. And I met some blues players. I met some folk players, some banjo players, clawhammer banjo players. And so all of that, just through the people that I met and what was going on, it really did start to kind of seep into my own music.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost. land is condemned. All the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem.
You're listening to music from Beth Bombara's new album. It's called Map and No Direction. This is GLT Sound Ideas. You mentioned blues music just a minute ago, and you covered a bluesy song, Bob Dylan's song, Blind Willie McTell, who is the blues legend itself. Did you get a sampling of that music growing up, or is it just when you got to St. Louis and you started tapping into that?
You know, yeah, it really was just kind of when I got to St. Louis. I didn't really grow up with a lot of older music, and so I know a lot of musicians, that's kind of their path. You know, they grew up listening to a lot of old stuff, learn how to play it, but for me it was very different. It was really kind of when I moved to St. Louis that I started experiencing that all.
What was it about Blind Willie McTell that you wanted to cover? Why did you want to cover this song?
I don't really know, except that, you know, the first time I heard it, I was like, I gotta listen to that again, and it was something I kept coming back to, and it just struck me in this way. I really wanted to sing it.
Well, Beth Bombara, it's nice to talk with you, and I know folks are looking forward to seeing you in Chillicothe on Sunday. Thank you for your time. Congratulations on the album.
Thank you so much, John.
Singer-songwriter Beth Bombara plays the Chillicothe Public Library Sunday afternoon beginning at 2 p.m. You're listening to GLT News and Ideas. Thanks for joining us, along with Laura Kennedy, John Norton, Mike McCurdy, and Ryan Denham on WGLT Normal. Find full episodes and individual stories from Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.